February 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm Liz Luchtendorf, because James O'Malley has the man flu. This week, we answer the questions. Do T-Rexes used to eat other T-Rexes, or is that a load of cannibals? Is open access publishing in history going to be Gutenberg or Battenberg? Should we let the Royal Institution fail? Has it had its fair a day? And are hereditary seats in the House of Lords chosen by peer-to-peer networking? But before we begin, why not support the Pod Delusion and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation? We really appreciate all the donations, and they help keep us making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, way back on episode 162, we spoke to Ethan Perlstein to discuss crowdsourced funding for pharmaceutical drug research. Today, we've got another research project that is looking to be funded via this approach. This project is in a slightly different area: dinosaurs. Unfortunately, it's not all about crowdfunding Jurassic Park just yet, but it's trying to do something almost as cool. Paleontologist Dave Hone wants to study cannibalism in giant tyrannosaurs. Kash Farooq caught up with Dave to talk about the project, and started by asking him about his main area of expertise.
I probably have quite a few if you thrash them out. I'm rather more of a generalist researcher than a lot of my colleagues, but I do a lot of work on behavior and ecology of dinosaurs, and in particular the predatory dinosaurs, the carnivorous group called theropods, which includes all the things like T-Rex and Velociraptor and Spinosaurus and Allosaurus that everyone's heard of, but also a bunch of other non-carnivorous forms. There are various herbivores and even omnivores in there, and basically trying to work out who they fed on, how they fed on each other, what this means for maybe population and evolution, and the various physical features of them that allowed them to do this kind of stuff.
Okay, you're trying to get funding for a particular project. Can you explain what this project is?
Yeah, well, what it is I've got contacted by a colleague of mine in Canada who's actually a fossil preparator. So the main part of his job is literally getting the bones and skulls and teeth out of the rock. But he has a very wide range of research that he does on the side. And he's got a lovely skull of a Tyrannosaur dinosaur. This is something very close to T-Rex. And the species is called, or the genus is called Daspletosaurus. And this Daspletosaurus skull has got a bunch of marks across it, which match up with known bite marks from other dinosaurs. So it looks like another large Tyrannosaur dinosaur had been biting the skull of this Daspletosaurus. And actually, the most likely candidate to have done this is another Daspletosaurus. So actually, what it looks like is dinosaur-on-dinosaur cannibalism. But to actually work out whether or not this genuinely was the case, and what kind of marks are exactly there, and how they were left, and what this means both for potential cannibalism and feeding patterns in general, my colleague Darren has called me in and wants me to go over and do this project with him because, as I say, I do a lot of work on this, and in particular, I've done quite a lot of work on bite marks, and particularly actually bite marks and feeding traces left by tyrannosaurs. So I'm probably one of very few people in the world who's really qualified to do this research.
So basically, this specimen's just sitting around and waiting to be described. It hasn't been fully described yet.
No. So Darren, who I think he actually found it as well, but he did the preparation work and first found the marks. He put out a short abstract a few years ago at a local conference in Canada, basically mentioning the fact that these bite marks are on there, and that's the limit of its existence in the scientific literature. You know, it has been mentioned in a conference talk and in a, you know, 10-line abstract somewhere a couple of years ago, and no serious work's been done on it. I think in part because they've been waiting for someone who's prepared to come out and do the work and has the expertise to try and diagnose all this stuff.
On your website for the funding, I watched the video and it was talking about how you can make discoveries based on the environment. Can you go into more detail there?
Well, I actually don't know the details of this yet. That's one of the things we need to sort out and check the site ourselves firsthand, ideally. But it's these kinds of things that you need to take into account. It's very easy to look at certain kinds of bones and you might find, you know, a major break in association with a bite mark and go, okay, this looks like the animal has come in, bitten hard and broken the bone. But if there's evidence from the bed where it was collected, that that had been through a lot of transport. In other words, you know, an animal that's died near or close to a riverbed. We get flash floods and things like this all the time, which are just the kind of things which are likely to bury bones. Of course, it then becomes perfectly possible that a large rock has smashed it in the wash through rather than animal biting on it. So you need, ideally, to know the exact circumstances in which this animal was transported and buried prior to discovery. And a lot of stuff that we find bite marks on is actually stuff that's collected years and years ago. You know, you're trawling through collections and trying to check every single bone to see what is on there. And if you don't know exactly when and where it came from and exactly how it was dug up and maybe what orientation it was in the rock at the time, things like this, you can miss these details and it can maybe lead you into a false conclusion.
Okay, let's move on to the crowdsourcing aspects of this research. Can you briefly explain what the concept is?
Yeah, I think it's basically much like these kind of Kickstarter projects for guys wanting to do little film projects or art projects and things like this. It's an opportunity for researchers like me to offer up a project to the public and say, this, I think, is a very cool piece of work. This is something that I can't afford to do through traditional funding methods or owing to time constraints or current employment situations. You know, you need to be in a permanent job to get research grants usually. All these other factors. This is something I think the public are going to be interested in. And of course, if, you know, a great many people contribute only a very small amount of money, you can reach quite a large total very quickly. You know, anyone giving even £2 or £5 goes quite a long way when several hundred people are prepared to do that. And of course, it's also a very different way of getting people involved in science. I do lots of outreach, I do blogs and podcasts and things like this, but this is people having the opportunity to say, this is some research that I'm interested in and think should go ahead, and I'm willing to directly contribute to that with some funding. There's no real way of saying, I love dinosaurs, I want dinosaur research or dinosaur ecology research to go ahead and I'm prepared to support that. There's really no way of doing that, and these crowdsourced projects provide that opportunity. And that, I think, is fantastic. And of course, what's kind of linked to that in a sense is obviously I will be blogging the project as I go through it. You know, there is a website there, we're on a thing called MicroRiser, is the guys who are hosting this. You know, there is comment threads on that. You can contact me directly and ask me questions about the project and I can answer them. You know, we are in a position for this to and fro. You can really chat about things as we're doing them, how we've planned it, what we want to do, how we're trying to go and go about it, which is not something you get very often.
So do you think this sort of funding will become the norm?
I doubt it will become the norm because obviously, you know, big projects, you need serious backing. I can, however, see it becoming very popular and very common because, as I say, there are lots of reasons why people might struggle to get funding even under the best circumstances. If you're not under a permanent research contract, you're not eligible for many. A lot of things particularly aimed at students or first-time postdocs and things like that, funds can often be very limited. They can often take years to generate. You know, there may only be one round of funding per year and it takes 3 or 4 months to hear back, and then you don't get it and you got to start again. So, you know, it could take 2, 3, 4 years to get the money through often, whereas these things, some of them are done in 30 days, 60 days. And particularly, therefore, with small projects where it's only, you know, a few thousand dollars or a few thousand pounds that you want to do at short notice, particularly if there's an urgent need for the money, you can do this. Actually, a good fossil example, you know, there are quite often cases where new fossil beds are uncovered or discovered when major excavation projects are going on. I dug up some footprints in Peru years ago where they'd cleared the land to build a road and suddenly found a wealth of footprints. Now, that road is going to get built in the next couple of months, regardless of what anyone says. And yet, if it took 3 or 4 years to get the money together to send a team out to look at these and excavate them and collect them, you know, the stuff's just not going to exist. But if you can put out an appeal, if we can get the money together in 30 days, we can send a team out and fix this problem. You know, that's something you're in a position to do with this kind of funding. So that, I think, it can have a really dramatic effect and therefore become very common for these kinds of little projects or things at short-term notice or things where people are otherwise limited in their funding, which is ultimately where I come in. I'm only on a short-term contract at the moment. That means I'm not eligible for a lot of the major funds, and I only need a little bit, basically.
So how long is it left, and how do people contribute?
It's running for 2 months, and that's been going for about 5 days already. So we've still got, you know, till the end of February or start of March to contribute. So we have got a good bit of time left. Quite simply, the main thing to do is just go to the website. It's on MicroRiser. These are the guys who are hosting the site. You'll find us as Project Daspletosaurus, and basically just log yourself in. It's just an email address, and pledge what you can afford to give us if you're happy to do that. As I say, even, you know, kind of token amounts, even 2, 3, 4, 5 quid. If a couple of hundred people do that, we go a long way very, very quickly. So, yeah, even small amounts, very generously received. Please also email and let people know. Just spreading the word is a big part. And there's also a shop on Redbubble, because a friend of mine did the design for the project logo, and he's selling T-shirts and birthday cards and things with that on. Some of the money from that goes through to us as well. So there's ways of getting cash to us. As I say, we're only looking for a small amount. It's basically to cover a flight and a couple of weeks in a hotel. That's all I'm looking for. But that will allow us to write up this project. We're going to stick it in an OA journal. I'm going to blog the whole thing. So hopefully there's a lot of interaction, a lot of fun to be had for a couple of pounds, if you can spare it.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll put all this on the Podillusion website. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Cash. Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
There's a war going on amongst historians at the moment over open access publishing. Now, they say that history is written by the winners, but if the opponents of open access win, it probably won't be read by many people at all. This week, Rich Godby here gives us his take on the situation. Personally, I'm looking forward to hearing the postmodernist, postcolonist, and Marxist interpretations of what he has to say. Here's Rich with more.
Let me begin with a joke. How many Oxbridge Dons does it take to change a light bulb? What on earth do you mean, change? This week, members of the Royal Historical Society turned on David Willetts, the university's minister. Their concern was not over the growing debt burden inflicting young students, nor the near catastrophic drop in student numbers since the introduction of these fees, but something much closer to their hearts: the future of academic publishing. Before I continue, I think I should outline, for those outside the academy, what all the fuss is about. Academic publishing is very important to the acquisition of knowledge in the Western world. Pretty much every great scientific discovery, every historical insight, every social claim have been subject to the process of peer review and academic publishing. It works like this. A researcher does their research, then writes a paper detailing that research and the conclusions reached. They then submit the paper to an appropriate academic journal within their field. The paper then undergoes the process of peer review. A group of anonymous experts in the same field review the paper and decide whether it's a viable argument, whether it's accurate, and most worryingly, whether it's worthy of their journal. If it ticks all the boxes, it gets included in a future journal. If it's not quite right, it's returned to the author with notes. This is known as revise and resubmit, and usually means you will get published once you've taken their advice. If it's not up to standard at all, with no hope of recovery, then it's completely rejected. The funding for this process comes through the use of a paywall. Journals often charge fees for individual papers, as well as big fees to access the entire journal, which they'll charge to universities and relevant institutions. Once upon a time, it meant the journals would be delivered in the form of a huge book. More recently, journals have gone online, and groups like JSTOR and Wiley allow institutions to pay a single fee or a series of fees for different chunks to access a vast online catalogue of information. This means that most people in most universities can access any article on any subject they want, and the rather vast fees, and by vast I mean do you want a house or do you want to pay for JSTOR for a decade, are paid for by the universities. There are problems with this setup. Firstly, not all universities can afford these vast sums and end up only getting, for example, part of the JSTOR catalogue. This creates a two-tier system within universities. Secondly, there has become a ranking in journals, with certain journals becoming more prestigious. Worse still is that some journals refuse to publish replications. For example, psychologist Daryl Bem recently published a paper which claimed to have evidence that people can predict the future, and it was published with some media fanfare on top of it being in a very major journal. What wasn't trumpeted was that people who tried to replicate this like Professor Chris French and Professor Richard Wiseman, failed. The journals openly stated that they don't publish replications, and this is a problem. It leads to an information bias within journals. The biggest problem, though, is the paywall. This has been highlighted by the recent sad death of Aaron Schwartz, a man whose downloading of a huge number of JSTOR articles in order to highlight the problem led to his arrest and perhaps contributed to his suicide. If you're not a member of a wealthy university, you can't access the journals without paying as much as $20 per paper to do so. I worked out that the paper I'm currently working on contains 25 journal articles in its bibliography so far. So far, it would have cost me nearly £320 if I wasn't a member of a university. This means it's impossible for researchers outside of any established group or institution to gain information. And we now live in an information age. Such knowledge should surely not be kept behind these locked doors. But there is a solution. 10 years ago, the group PLOS, Public Library of Science, began. It had a very different model. It would publish academic papers, but instead of charging the readers of the papers, it would charge the authors. Often the costs, which can be quite high, between $1,350 and $2,900, are factored into the research funding proposals of the researchers or subsidised by the institution at which the researcher resides. More importantly, although it has rigorous peer review, just as rigorous as the other journals, it published based on the accuracy and only the accuracy of the material submitted. In other words, it lets the scientific community decide the paper's relevance and importance. It happily publishes replications, failed or confirmed. It means that all the information is available to everyone. It is intellectually egalitarian, with no access barriers for those who just wish to dip into this great knowledge. Recently, the Open Library of the Humanities was announced, a group who wished to apply the same model for the humanities and social sciences. David Willett thinks this is a great idea and wants all UK academic publishing to go this way. And this brings us back to the Royal Historical Society. They, along with the Political Studies Association and the Council for the Defence of British Universities, claim that it is an attack on academic freedoms with possible unintended consequences. The argument is that, as universities will be footing the bill for submission, another layer, if you like, of peer review will be created in which university management, who aren't anonymous, will be able to give thumbs up or down to the submission of papers by its researchers. This means that uni administrators and managers will be deciding where and what to publish, not the academics. But I think this is an example of people being Luddites. Firstly, I very much doubt this will happen. Most members of university managements are academics themselves and no more want this new level of peer review than those they manage. Even if they're ex-academics and, as has been accused, they are following the government agenda in a ploy to help open access bolster the economy, I can't work out how to come to this conclusion. To me, it's a bit of a straw man argument. It makes no sense. And the real reason it makes no sense, what really bursts this straw bubble, is a quick look at the Open Library of Humanities mission statement. In it, it states that as well as going through rigorous peer review and all the several things you'd expect, it is non-discriminatory. In other words, the fees are waiverable. If you cannot afford to submit because you don't have funding, or, God forbid, this dystopia forms and you don't have management thumbs up from your institution, but they think your paper is accurate and worth publishing, they will waive the fees. I know people who've submitted to PLOS independently and found that the wavering of fees took a short email exchange on receipt of an invoice. Management can create all the draconian scrutinising publication procedures it likes, but you can just go behind their back. And unless they put it into your contract that you're not going to do that, in which case I would suggest seeing some serious union advice, this dystopia is not going to happen. I think that open access publishing is the future. Fear of change is rife within the academy. The joke at the beginning is an example of that. But I firmly believe that the sum of human knowledge and achievement should be accessible to all. And if that puts a few academic noses out of joint, so be it. I have pledged to publish within the Open Library of the Humanities within 1 year of their inception. And here and now, I go further. I pledge to only ever publish through open access journals for my entire career once they have begun to publish. It's a pledge I'd like many of my fellow future and current academics to take with me. The pledge to publish within 1 year, you can go online, just put in Open Library of the Humanities into Google and you'll find the pledge there. Please take that pledge. But go on, take this further pledge with me. This is Richard Firthgod here for The Pod Delusion.
listened to last week's show, you may remember we featured a piece about the campaign to save the Royal Institution, which a couple of weeks ago announced that they were looking into selling their famous building in Mayfair because they've run out of money. I guess they couldn't find any loose change down the back of their recently refitted £22 million sofa. Anyway, this week we've got a bit of a rebuttal to last week. Dr. T has been wondering if the money could be better spent. And also, what's the point of the RI anyway?
On last week's Pod Delusion, James interviewed Mary Perkins regarding her campaign to save 21 Albemarle Street, the home of the Royal Institution. I should start by saying that I'm pretty sure the RI and Albemarle Street will survive, together and intact. Many famous and eminent scientists who I love and respect are fighting for it, and it feels odd for me not to be joining them and giving it my support. I listened with interest and attentively to Mary's report, but remain entirely unconvinced that saving the current residents of the RI is something I feel I can support, and in the next few minutes I want to lay out my arguments. Firstly, we need to separate the argument for saving the RI from the argument for saving its home in Mayfair. The RI's strapline is connecting people with the world of science. A few hundred years ago, it may well have been a necessity to have an open access institute where people could come and share their science and research. But today? Who was the last groundbreaking scientist who felt the need to go to Mayfair in London to communicate their ideas with the public? Think of how much of the UK demographic in terms of geography and socioeconomics that excludes. Here are the main reasons that Mary put forward as to why the location needed to be kept. Firstly, the Faraday Research Labs. Having a research lab in one of the most expensive areas in London is not essential. The quality of the research would be no different in any other part of London or elsewhere in the UK. That's not to denigrate the awesome work that goes on there, just that if it didn't happen at Albemarle Street, it would probably still happen. Secondly, the Christmas lectures. These could be done from anywhere. Surely if the RI was genuinely interested in communicating science to kids outside of London, they would take it round various UK cities rather than continually holding it in the famous, if uncomfortable, Faraday Lecture Theatre in West London. Even if the RI moved to another location, there's no reason why the lecture theatre couldn't be painstakingly moved too, for those who feel religious about it, as if the essence of Faraday is somehow with them in that holy place in the Cathedral of Science. Thirdly, the RI channel. This is the collection of online videos of previous Christmas lectures and the like, which by its very definition does not require a giant expensive event space in London. These are the things that people know the RI for, but none of them rely on the building. Science isn't the hot topic in the heart of Mayfair, but it is on blogs and tweets and papers and pub meetups, which are happening all over the country without the dusty institute at the helm. The main proponents for keeping Albemarle Street argue from a sense of history and historical scientific value. But I'm not convinced that its place in history alone is enough to warrant survival at any cost. Perhaps a comparison to Bletchley Park is opposite. It was in dire need of funding and came close to collapsing, but successfully negotiated funding from public and private purses, not only out of a sense of historic entitlement, but by laying out clearly its plan for the future and its plan for survival. The next question is the RI doing what it's supposed to be doing? My answer is, I'm not sure. I have a PhD, as does my wife, yet neither of us during our combined 3 decades of science education and work life came across the RI in any format apart from the Christmas lectures. Maybe a sample of 2 is not enough, but I have a hunch that we're not alone. From my experience, UK science hasn't needed the RI for decades. The RI has continued to be, but this is all it seems to do. It exists purely with the aim of existing. As if because it can throw some famous names on the table, it has a right to survive at all costs. It was once a world-renowned, important scientific keystone, but how relevant is it today? If the RI sold off its premises and closed itself down, would there be a loss to UK science education? In my opinion, nothing that couldn't be taken up elsewhere. The main jewel in the RI crown, the Christmas lectures, could easily continue without it. Mary skipped over the finer details of why the RI suddenly finds itself selling off the family silver in order to survive. Baroness Susan Greenfield was director of the RI. You might remember her for having some ideas about, quote, the damage that the gadget-filled, pharmaceutically enhanced 21st century is doing to our brains. But ideas were all they were, as she refused to publish any evidence for her ideas, instead using her access to media to promote them and bypass scrutiny. This is completely at odds with the scientific method and how science works. It demeans science to a level of untested ideas and uncritical relativism. This from the person who is supposed to be the head of the institute which claims to connect people with the world of science. Any credible science promotion organisation, I would have thought, would be embarrassed to have such an opposing force to robust scientific testing at its helm. I guess, with Prince Charles as vice patron, the RI has never insisted on their top brass being too on message. Greenfield oversaw a refurbishment, with support of the Governing Council, of the RI home, at a cost of £22 million. The idea was to create an event space and a fine dining experience. Nothing says inclusivity and the dissemination of science to the public like a fine dining event space in the middle of Mayfair. As the downturn kicked in, the event space didn't bring in the expected cash, and the RI is now saddled with £7 million worth of debt and can't currently pay its running costs. Albemarle Street doesn't need rescuing because of underfunding. It needs it because of a failed renovation involving millions of pounds of charity money. So back to Mary's Pod Delusion piece. She is asking us to sign a petition to get the government to bail out the RI for their risky financial project that went wrong so that it can continue to exist. Nothing about the future, just to exist. Having spent the last number of years grumbling about bank bailouts, I would be a tremendous hypocrite to argue that it's okay for the RI to be bailed out and not banks because science. Remember, it's a charity. Value for money should be paramount out of respect to your donors. Eminent scientists like Bruce Hood have pressed the importance of inspiring buildings, a sense of history, places of science wonder which play a valuable part in the societal role of science. But ugly economics have to come into play at some point. Of course, I don't want to see the RI fail or the site sold off. I want the RI to reinvent itself and for people to have the same awe and respect for the building as they did back during its heyday. But it can't expect that of the public. It needs to do the graft. It needs to fulfil its desire of informing the public about science. Mary asked us to help by joining the RI at a cost of £28 as an associate member. Sure, pay 28 quid so the RI, which burned through its own cash, can continue to rent out space below cost and feed posh people food in Mayfair under the guise of science communication. Okay, so maybe I'm trolling a little bit. But if you actually care about science communication to the public, rather than dewy-eyed history dressed up as science communication, I'm willing to bet that pound for pound your 28 quid would go a lot further if you donated it to the Pod Delusion. Last week's show had a piece about upside-down backbones in tetrapods and the ethics of cloning Neanderthals. One episode of the Pod Delusion introduced me to more novel scientific ideas than a lifetime of the RI. And it doesn't have a holy building. This is Dr. T, running for cover from angry scientists for the Pod Delusion.
Exciting news! Democracy is finally coming to the House of Lords, and you'll get a vote too, as long as your surname is something like Poshington Smythe and your dad owns half of Wiltshire. Basically, if you're on the Tatler list, you're probably part of this electorate. That's right. In this next piece, Corey Hazlehurst tells us all about the bizarre circumstance by which hereditary peers are replaced in the Lords. Just think, though unlike in America, kids here can't grow up hoping one day to be president, but at least little Jemima of Francis can one day hope to be a lifetime member of the Upper House without having to ever encounter any actual poor people. To explain more, here's Corey.
Voter turnout in by-elections is notoriously rubbish. It's become a bit of a truism to say that most people don't bother trudging through the ice and snow on a cold winter's day to participate in the democratic process. The last by-election was held on November the 29th, when, as butters often do, three turned up at once. In two of the three, Middlesbrough and Croydon North, turnout barely hovered above a quarter. That compares to about 60% of voters who dutifully cast their vote in those seats in the 2010 general election. Despite this, however, the winning candidate got around 10,000 to 15,000 votes, which seems astronomical compared to the by-election taking place on February the 13th. On that day, a new member of the House of Lords will be selected, not by the good people of Tyneside, Croydon or anywhere else, but by just 41 Conservative peers. Regular Pod Delusion listeners may remember my earlier piece on House of Lords reform around 18 months ago. Nick Clegg's scheme was derailed, mainly because of a large Tory backbench revolt. It's ironic that, as a result of this failure, the only members of the Lords which are elected are the hereditary peers. These hereditaries, of course, are only in Parliament because their dad was, and their granddad was, and probably their great-granddad was as well, all the way back to William the Conqueror. In 1997, New Labour came to power on a manifesto commitment to eject all the 800-plus hereditary peers from the House of Lords. In the end, it didn't wish to spend a huge amount of time and political capital pushing through its reforms, so a compromise was reached. In 1999, all but 92 of the hereditary peers were removed from the upper chamber. Those that remained were elected by the hereditaries themselves. Ironically, the electoral system used by the hereditary peers to elect their candidates is the alternative vote. Some of you may recall that AV is the voting system rejected by the electorate in the May 2011 referendum, much to the chagrin of Nick Clegg. I do find it quite amusing that our unelected lords use a superior voting system than we do to elect MPs, or at least I can laugh at it through my bitter, bitter tears. The composition of these 92 hereditary peers was agreed to be set at 42 Conservatives, 28 crossbenchers, 3 Labour, 2 Lib Dem, and 15 so-called deputy speakers, who'd be elected by all members of the House of Lords. Those listeners who are up on their mental maths would have spotted that that only makes 90 peers. The other two hereditary peers are the royal office holders, the Lord Great Chamberlain and the Earl Marshal. When a peer dies, the remaining members of the hereditary peers from his party elect a successor. This latest by-election has been caused by the death in November of Robert Shirley, the 13th Earl of Ferrers. By all accounts, he seems to have been an all-round good egg, holding ministerial positions in the Ministry of Agriculture and the Department for the Environment, as well as having been chief whip in the Lords. Having bashed a number of elected Lords, I should probably mention a tribute to Earl Ferrers in The New Statesman, which isn't a natural home for a sycophancy towards peers. Caroline Crampton wrote that men like the Earl were, and I quote, through an accident of birth, placed in a position of power and went about their jobs with good humour, hard work and individuality. He also apparently threw a fish at the Tory chief whip for the Lords in the 80s, and who hasn't wanted to throw a fish at a Tory at one point? The remaining 41 Tory peers will elect, via the much maligned AV system, a new hereditary peer from the ranks of those removed from the House of Lords in 1999. The bookies' favourites for the post include the 5th Baron of Borwick, the 2nd Earl of Stockton, the 4th Baron de Ramsay, and the 6th Marquess of Abergavenny. And I promise I haven't just made those up. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to 21st century meritocratic Britain. This by-election is an interesting thing because it highlights some of the more insane anachronisms in the British Constitution. It was, after all, in the 18th century when Thomas Paine wrote that a hereditary ruler makes no more rational sense than a hereditary dentist. Yet 3 centuries later, we still have people passing laws because of their bloodline rather than because of their ability. Indeed, some of the laws governing hereditary peers are dated in the extreme. Paragraph 10 on the Ministry of Justice's guidance notes on succession to a hereditary peer states that, and I quote, it should also be noted that a child born as a result of egg, sperm or embryo donation is incapable of succeeding to a peerage held by or transmitted through those persons who are otherwise to be treated in law as the child's parents. Now that might make sense to breed cattle in that way, but I'm not sure it really works for our lawmakers. Another anachronism is the fact that more than half of our parliament who make our laws are unaccountable to the public. The election of hereditary peers is in many ways the last of Britain's rotten boroughs. In 2005, all 4 Lib Dem peers voted for the Earl of Glasgow in the by-election to replace the late Earl Russell. This is an election result which neatly combines the provincial fix of a 19th century rotten borough with the 100% victory margin of Joseph Stalin. The vast majority of hereditary peers are party functionaries, artificially skewed to overrepresent Conservative peers, yet we have no say at all over their appointment. The composition of the House of Lords has changed over the past 15 years, from membership being founded on the hereditary principle, I sit here because my dad did, to being political appointees, I sit here because my party leader said I can. Now, this is progress, to be sure, but we should not pretend that shifting the patronage to political parties has been unproblematic. In many cases, it means the House of Lords can now be a repository for failed politicians. Take, for instance, the fact that Douglas Hogg was thought to be an interested candidate in this by-election to replace the late Earl of Ferrers. Hogg, you may recall, is the ex-MP most famous for claiming the cleaning of his moat on expenses. It has also meant that political appointees have become less rebellious, more likely to toe the party line, and yet still unable to face any public scrutiny. Any further reform to the House of Lords, which I believe is necessary sooner rather than later, should shift the Lords from being responsible to their party leaders to being responsible to the public. Electing Lords by single transferable vote, a combination of an open primary and a general election, would be a neat way of allowing the election of independently minded candidates, as well as those from smaller parties, and would stop the Lords being full of unaccountable flunkies. The House of Lords by-election does shine a light on some of the darker aspects of the British Constitution, and it turns out that it hasn't really been fit for purpose since 1708. This was Corey Hazlehurst for The Pod Delusion.
Now, whilst in this country we have a pretty robust fire safety culture, it isn't always the case elsewhere. For instance, in America, the NRA are insistent that the best way to stop a fire is with another fire, even though the rest of the world can clearly see that this is rather counterintuitive. This week, Claire Benson has been thinking about a recent horrific fire in Brazil and how we have health and safety people to thank for it not happening here.
As a fire scientist, I'm often asked about explosives or how to get away with arson. Sometimes the more sanguine subjects like murder or spontaneous human combustion come up. But it amuses me that I'm rarely asked about a subject far closer to my heart, health and safety. I've worked in the safety science field for over 8 years, but trying to have a conversation with people about insulation or faulty regulators can be rather, well, challenging. And yet I think people should be more interested, or at least more aware of the importance of the issues. The recent Brazilian nightclub fire in Santa Maria was a shocking reminder of what can happen when the systems put in place to keep people safe fail completely. At university as an undergrad student, I remember studying the Stardust Disco fire. That happened back in 1981. After the fire broke out, the poorly trained staff failed to raise the alarm immediately, with fatal results. Materials melted and smoked, lights failed, creating a panicked stampede. All this was made worse by the fact that many of the fire exits had been locked or blocked, and it resulted in the deaths of 48 people. That fire happened the year before I was born, and although fire licenses were required, there were relatively few controls on emergency procedures and on the space use. Many of the materials used produced a lot more smoke than would be allowed today, and some may even have given off poisonous gases like cyanide or formaldehyde, making the smoke horribly toxic. You'd think that 30 years of scientific knowledge and building regulations would mean that such a thing could never happen again. And yet, it has. And unfortunately, it isn't surprising. On their website, the British Association for Human Identification list 4 similar fires between 2003 and 2008 that collectively resulted in the deaths of 338 people and the injury of 995. While watching reports on the Santa Maria fire, I felt extremely angry, and I also have to admit, guiltily, a little grateful. Working in the fire and explosion safety science field, and working closely with the London Fire Brigade, I've learned just how seriously fire safety is taken in the UK. The words health and safety get a very bad rep in the media, and in our society in general. Be it in conversations down the pub or in snarky posts on Facebook, people love to exclaim how ridiculous our world has become. I didn't wear a crash helmet when I was young, and look at me! It's laughable. Laughable, that is, until tragedy strikes. And when it does, we feel relieved we weren't there, and that our loved ones haven't had to go through that sort of ordeal. But we don't perhaps appreciate as deeply as we should all of the work that has gone into making you feel as safe as you do. In fact, there seems to be something of an assumption when there is a disaster abroad that that could never happen here. Indeed, the irony of modern society is expressed fabulously in our simultaneous beliefs that health and safety is in our way and will save us from peril, that the rules will save us while we whinge about them. Gladly, as I said, the chances are very slight, but I wonder how much people really understand the measures taken behind the scenes. I'm not defending those ridiculous actions we often read about in the newspapers, where companies refuse to allow perfectly reasonable things to happen, blaming health and safety, while they really mean that they're afraid of being sued. They are inexcusable. There is a fabulous and often very funny section of the Health and Safety Executive website called Putting the Record Straight, where the chair and other members of the organisation express their bemusement at such stupid stories, resulting from ridiculous excuses as to why SpongeBob SquarePants was not allowed to light the Christmas lights in Wolverhampton, and other similar tales, seemingly sprung from the imagination of satirists. I'm defending the planning inspectors, architects, lawyers, fire engineers, scientists, and of course the fire brigades and health and safety executive, who work so hard on our behalf. We are lucky enough to live in a place where our escape is safeguarded from a building well before it starts burning. Fire retardant materials will be used in construction. Stairwells will be guarded with concrete to keep escape routes clear. There will be more than one exit to prevent you from being trapped, and for workplaces, emergency lighting and fire warning systems will be provided to give you ample warning and direction to keep you safe from harm. It's far too early to know the exact circumstances of the fire in Brazil. However, reports already suggest that it involved a flare or sparks being lit on stage, a single fire exit, vast amounts of smoke, and panic. These elements have been seen time and time again and tend to be repeated when the system of inspection fails those most relying on it. I've been asked several times in the last few days what the solution is. How can we stop these fires happening again? But the answer isn't easy. I think we have enough knowledge of fire dynamics, of materials, and of the behaviour of people under emergency situations already that it shouldn't happen again. It shouldn't have happened this time. Perhaps it won't happen again, but the fact remains that safety precautions don't make money, and in the times of austerity, where cost-cutting is necessary, they may start to suffer. We currently have an excellent safety culture in the UK, displayed by the fact that although we have one of the highest occurrences of fire in Europe, we have one of the lowest death rates from fire. Last year, The Guardian reported that the Health and Safety Executive will have its budget cut by 35% by the year 2014. And the London Fire Brigade budget is being similarly reduced, their budget being constricted by £45 million. And there is concern that public safety might suffer. But I don't want to finish this story by depressing or terrifying you. You should feel lucky that you live in a country that values your safety, proud that the government spend the same amount of money maintaining workplace safety as the USA does for five times the population. We should all be grateful that we are, to a certain extent, allowed to be complacent because there are, all the time, people taking care of us. But next time you read the words, "It's health and safety gone mad," spare a thought for people living in a crazy world without it. This is Claire Benson, recording for The Pod Delusion.
Now over in America, it appears that religious fundamentalists are taking over the classroom, which I guess at least makes a nice change from the government. In this next piece, Salim Foudley has been speaking to Dan Quinn from the Texas Freedom Network to find out more.
Founded in 1995, the Texas Freedom Network is America's largest state-based religious freedom organization. Unlike many of the groups we like to feature on the Pod Delusion, the Texas Freedom Network does not promote an anti-religious agenda, more a strictly constitutional separation of church and state. And I can't think of anywhere in the United States where that kind of message is needed more than in the state of Texas, where a school board dominated by religious fundamentalists has rewritten educational guidelines in such a way as to promote right-wing and Protestant dogma in the classroom. The Texas Freedom Network has recently concluded a study of teaching methods used in Texan Bible classes. The findings were astonishing. Kooks and fundamentalists had taken over the classroom. Kids were being taught that Judaism was an incomplete religion and were given supplementary lesson materials sourced from sites like raptureready.org. I began by asking Dan Quinn, the Texas Freedom Network's communications director, just who let these crazy people into Texan public school classrooms?
You know, in the United States, we have in the Constitution a very strict separation of church and state. Now, there are many people in the United States who oppose that, and in fact, think that the Constitution does not protect separation of church and state. But regardless, the courts have said that. The courts also allow public schools to teach courses about the influence of the Bible in history and literature, sort of a cultural literacy course, provided that the courses are academic in nature and not devotional. Our report found that many of these courses are very devotional. The big problem is the teachers teaching these courses don't know what they're doing. They're not getting the training they need about how to do this in an academically and legally appropriate way. And in many cases, then, they just fall back on their own personal religious instruction. And that allows a lot of religious bias in these classrooms and, frankly, a lot of fringe nonsense.
Nonsense seems to be the right word. Some of the materials that your study observed were being used in classes really are quite shocking. I can't use any other word. One document used in a classroom explains that people of Africa should be thought of as Canaanites, a people forever cursed by God because their ancestor saw Noah in the nude. This particular biblical interpolation has been used to justify racism and even slavery. It's also utter nonsense, isn't it? Are there really no controls that could stop this kind of material in classes?
Well, there are some controls. The unfortunate thing is they're not being implemented. The legislature in Texas in 2007 passed a bill that included a number of guidelines that my organization helped put into the bill that would help these schools do this in a better way and leave that kind of nonsense out. One is teacher training. Train teachers how to do these courses in a legally and an academically appropriate way. We also wanted very specific curriculum standards from the state that would help guide these districts about what's worthwhile in teaching these courses. If you really want a course about the cultural importance of the Bible in history and literature, then guide the school districts in how to do this in the right way. Don't just throw the door open and let them run out and hire ministers and other folks who just come in and teach these courses from their own religious point of view. The problem that we've seen, of course, is many of these courses teach the kind of stuff you're talking about. When you've got classes teaching students that the origins of racial diversity are Noah's sons, which, as you said, is a long discredited concept that racists have used to justify slavery, or you have classes teaching students that the Jews killed Jesus, which, of course, was long used to promote persecution of Jews, you've got a real problem. You also have a problem with the academic quality of these courses. This should also be offensive to people of faith themselves because it doesn't give a study of the Bible the respect that it deserves. In fact, it makes it a joke.
The state of Texas has historically had a very important role in setting the entire nation's educational agenda. Can you explain a little bit about why what happens in Texas affects not only Texan kids, but potentially school kids in the entire continent?
In the United States, education policies are essentially a state and local responsibility. The federal government can get involved in some ways, and you know, maybe some funding and some other guidelines. But for the most part, each state decides how it's going to run its education system. And that includes how it's going to purchase its textbooks and other materials that students use. Because Texas is so large, population-wise, we essentially dominate the textbook market in the country. So publishers will create their textbooks and materials for this state and then sell essentially the same materials to schools across the country. In a Bible course, because it's not a required course in every school district, there's probably a little bit less influence along those lines because there are fewer schools here buying it. But largely, Texas has become very influential in most of the core curriculum that you'd see taught in most schools across the country. That's become problematic in a number of ways. In history and government classes, for example, we have curriculum standards in Texas that religious conservatives have forced onto the books that require students to learn that separation of church and state may in fact not be a key principle of the Constitution, that promote religious conservative propaganda, essentially, in many cases. And then they expect textbook publishers to create textbooks that teach that. And then, of course, those textbooks will then be used in schools across the country. What happens in Texas doesn't stay in Texas when it comes to textbooks. The craziness that goes into our classrooms here makes its way into classrooms across the country.
I've noticed that the whole idea of religious freedom has been reframed. It used to mean a freedom of the individual citizens from interference and proselytizing from government organizations.
And now it sort of means the freedom of government organizations to proselytize and interfere with citizens' religious beliefs.
Yeah, in many cases, the religious right in this country is not a religious movement, it's a political movement. And the goal of that political movement is to use government as a tool to promote their own religious perspective over those of all others. They see the United States as a uniquely Christian nation with a government and laws based on their particular reading of the Bible. The founders of this country, of course, didn't see it that way at all. Many of them made it very explicit that government should stay out of this and that government has no role promoting or disparaging any particular religion. And that also means schools. The unfortunate thing is in these courses, we're now seeing that separation, that really important protection for religious freedom, cast aside, in some cases deliberately, in other cases because teachers simply know not what they do, to borrow the biblical phrase. I mean, they and through no fault of their own, they're not given the training that they need. They don't have the materials that they need to teach a good course. And so they fall back on their own religious training. And whether they want to or not, their own religious training, their own religious beliefs, then become what they're teaching in the classroom.
If you want to find out more about the Texas Freedom Network, you can follow the link in our show notes on poddelusion.co.uk. And you might also want to check out a major new documentary which follows the work of the Texas Freedom Network and other groups and individuals campaigning for church-state separation in Texas. It's called The Revisionaries, and we'll post a link to that as well. This is Salim Fadley for The Pod Delusion.
Conspiracy theorists have hit a new low recently following the shooting in Newtown. Some of them have been accusing the families there of being tragedy actors. Yeah, it's a bit grim. Here's Tom Hodden to explain more.
In the days following any tragedy, especially the stemming from acts of obscene violence, it is perfectly natural for a society to question how and why events were allowed to happen. And if they were the actions of an individual, to ask how and why that person felt the need to, and was able to, carry out an action that many of us consider abhorrent, something we cannot bring ourselves to understand. For the vast majority of us, this natural reaction does not take the form of carefully controlled peer-reviewed studies or academic investigation. It is purely emotional and instinctive. We have seen a danger, and therefore we should be doing something, we feel, to address the danger and to prevent it happening again. We find ourselves jumping upon the bandwagon. In broad strokes, we can recognise a pattern of responses that occur each time we as a society are faced with a suitably jarring turn of events. For those learned listeners in the relevant fields, I apologise in advance for my crude and simplistic layman understanding of this. In very broad strokes, we'll first see discussion of immediate causes. How did the individual obtain weapons, for example? Can stricter control of those weapons prevent another occurrence? Were there suitable security measures in the location of the tragedy? And so on. In the next broad stroke, we see the underlying influences of the individual Christians. How did they come to believe their actions were justified? Did they watch the wrong films, listen to the wrong music, play the wrong video games, or otherwise corrupt themselves? With some influence that we can blame, some mark we can place upon them as a scapegoat to say that is to blame, that made them the other, that is why we will never be like them. Justified or not, and it is definitely not in most cases, it seems to be human nature to convince ourselves that we will not become what we fear, before emotions settle and we can take a look again with more reasonable eyes. For some, though, as I've discussed here in the past, there is a third broad reaction, the conspiracy theory. It seems to me that for some people, the idea of an individual causing such violence in the heart of a society they want to believe to be safe and well protected by police forces and security services is so shocking and disconcerting that they would argue the only agencies capable of pulling off such an action are those very same all-powerful security agencies. We saw it with the assassination of JFK, with the terrorist attacks on 9/11, both generating conspiracy theories quite quickly. And we are seeing it now with more recent spree shootings in the United States. According to some, the US government committed or faked recent tragedies to justify changes in the firearms control laws. According to others, these events were faked by tragedy actors, with at least one Newtown resident having reported harassment by conspiracy theorists demanding to know how he could justify his involvement in the conspiracy and the body language of victims' families at public events being scrutinised by theorists wishing to prove they are actors playing to a script, pretending to have been victims to a staged event. Actors who play different roles in multiple tragedies for the US authorities. Of course, there's not a jot of viable evidence to support these claims, other than vague similarities between individuals in the backgrounds of photographs and a misunderstanding of how camera angles can make facial features seem rounder and sharper, and a complete ignorance of human psychology. The same flawed deductions that were once used to claim Lee Harvey Oswald was two men now linger to claim that entirely different people are, in fact, the same person. What this all illustrates is that those of us who wave away conspiracy theories, claiming they can be distasteful but do not actually harm people, might be wise to reconsider our opinions. Many conspiracy theories, by their nature, accuse somebody of something, and it is easy to assume that this will be a faceless, nameless member of an agency. But, starkly illustrated here, are individuals whose lives were already ruined by events also now having to defend themselves from the obscene and personal accusations made without proper evidence by conspiracy theorists. It seems to be a worrying trend. From behind the tinfoil hat, this has been Tom Hodden for The Pod Delusion.
Now a couple of quick plugs for a couple of exciting events coming up soon that are being run by student atheist groups. First up, earlier this week, James spoke to David Shorthouse to find out more about Oxford Think Week.
So I'm on the line now with David Shorthouse from Oxford Ash. David, thank you for joining us, and you're here to talk about Think Week. Could you start by telling us exactly what Think Week's all about?
Sure. Think Week is a festival we hold in Oxford every year. This is the fourth year it's been held. It's run collaboratively by the student societies in Oxford from both Oxford and Oxford Brookes, and the local humanist groups. And basically we attempt to tackle some issues relevant to the current climate, and we try and kind of push the humanist feeling on these issues, really.
And this year's festival is about death, I understand.
It is. This year's theme is death, and that's opened up some fantastic discussions this year. So we've got things on war, we've got assisted suicide, we've got ghosts, we've got talks about immortality. This is a really, really broad, really, really interesting topic.
Don't you think this is all a bit fluffy and lighthearted?
Well, I'd like to think we're hitting some hard issues as well, because we've got things like abortion in there. We're hoping to talk about kind of some hard science and immortality as well, which I'm hoping is going to be really interesting.
Excellent. So who have you got on the lineup then? I see you've got Richard Dawkins involved.
We do, as we have done for the last 2 years. We've got Richard Dawkins having a conversation with Stephen Law, which hopefully will be quite interesting. They're talking about major issues of importance to humanists and atheists at the moment.
And what else can people expect? Go on, tell us. What events are you looking forward to?
I think the main ones that I'm looking forward to are panel discussion with Sir John Stolston on overpopulation, and we're hopefully going to be sort of discussing whether overpopulation is actually going to be a problem in the future. Hopefully we're going to get both sides of that discussion, as well as kind of what we can do, what we can start thinking about doing to try and prevent this. I'm also very interested about our Saturday symposium, where we've got not only some kind of interesting poetry readings on death, but we've also got Francesca Stavrakopoulou from Exeter University, who some people might know from the BBC series Bible's Hidden Secrets.
Excellent. So where can people find out more, and when does it all take place?
If you go to our website, which is thinkweek.co.uk, you'll find everything, including eligibility for tickets for a couple of the events, which are all free. Everything is free, but we have to ticket some of them to make sure that we're not getting too many people turning up. And we start on February the 8th.
Brilliant, and I'm assuming that the overpopulation one will be ticketed so it doesn't overpopulate.
Yes, it will. I can tell you that it's not overpopulated yet, though, so there will still be tickets available.
Excellent, and we'll put links to find out about all of the events and all that on the Poddelusion website, but let's keep it short and sweet. David Shorthouse, thank you very much.
I've also been speaking to the president of the Federation of Student, Atheist, Humanist and Secular Societies, Jess Vautier, about the forthcoming AHS convention. I first asked Jess how the last year for the AHS went.
It's been really good, actually. We've had a non-profit week, which was in November. I can't remember the total amount we raised off the top of my head. We were raising money for various charities, though we were specifically hoping people would raise some money for Survivors Voice Europe, for survivors of abuse by Catholic clergy. And I think the society that raised the most was Southampton, who did, I think they managed to get about £400 between them, which was quite impressive. What else? We've done quite a few things this year. We've had two regional conventions as well, and both of them on the 1st of December, one in Scotland and one in Southampton, which were awesome. It's the first time we've had anything up in Scotland, which was really nice to be able to get them more involved, because they're usually a bit too far away to come to a lot of the London stuff. So yeah, it's been great.
Cool. And I guess one of the first big events of 2013 will be the AHS convention. What's going on with that?
Okay, well, we've got the AHS convention will be from the 1st to the 3rd of March. We're starting off on the Friday with welcome drinks at the Knights Templar on Chancery Lane. And then the second day, we've got a day of awesome speakers. So lots of impressive people coming to talk to students and anybody else who wants to come. Plus a load of different organisations will have stalls around the edge of Conway Hall for people to go up and have a chat to. And then the third day is a day of workshops for society leaders to help them run their societies better. So it's all very exciting.
And so how can people get to the event? Who can go to the event? And does it cost any money? I know it's a student thing, so, oh, you know, students.
Yeah, well, we're charging £10 for students and £12 for non-students. So it's something that everybody can come to, not just for the students. We wouldn't want to restrict people coming to listen to our awesome speakers. The second day, the workshop day, is just for the students, and that bit's free because we want to be able to help as many people as possible with that.
And I guess finally, the most important question is, like, where can people find out where the convention is, who's coming, and how to get tickets?
Okay, we have a Facebook event. We also have our Twitter account, which is AHS Students, and we'll be using the hashtag AHSCon. We've also got our very own mini site, which I hope we'll be able to have a link to below, which is ahsconvention.humanism.co. And you can also go to the BHA website on the events page, which is where our tickets are being sold from.
Great. Well, we'll put up links to the convention online. So yeah, Jess, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk to listen to over 3 years now of program archives, as well as like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Also, on our website, if you've enjoyed the show this week, why not do as Dr. T suggested and donate £28, the same as the Royal Institution membership? Or indeed, why not subscribe or donate £5 or £10 a month? You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. Poddelusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Rich Godbehere, Dr. T, Corey Hazelhurst, Claire Benson, Salim Badley, Tom Hodden, James O'Malley, and me, Liz Luttendorf. The Sketch in a Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Tu. The Poddelusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Have you seen the papers at all today, Mother?
Hard not to, Charles. They're all opened out on the table. One thought that a corgi was ill.
No, really?
Oh, and someone has ringed one story in each paper. Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands is abdicating.
Is she? Is she indeed? I hadn't noticed.
Yes, for her 75th birthday. Not much of a present, if you ask one.
But she gets to spend more time with the grandchildren than with her son in charge.
More time with them? Wills was like a limpet during the Jubilee, and one simply hasn't got the stamina for dressing up as a Nazi and playing strip billiards in Vegas with Harry.
Yeah, but her son might have some good ideas, you know, ways to help the country. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to spend more time with Father, you know, when he goes grouse shooting?
Charles, Philip goes scouse shooting, or sometimes on a mank hunt. Anyone that looks lower class, really.
A man's what?
Mank hunt, Charles. Hunting Mancunians.
Oh, thank heavens for that. What I mean, Mummy, is it can't be easy nowadays. That throne is cold and hard, and it must be the reason you keep having that anus horribilis, you know, playing havoc with your chalfonce. I think Queen Beatrix has the right idea.
Do you? Well, seeing in that photo in the paper how happy she looks, I think she may have had a good idea.
You what? Really? You mean...
Yes. One doesn't have a hat like the one she's wearing there. It would be a good idea to get one of those.
The hat? But I thought you were going to go...
One knows, Charles, one knows. But as they say, unum habet alium virginiti annos magnus ores.
I beg your pardon?
One has another 20 years, big ears. The only king you're going to be is king tired of waiting.
Don't!